Come on. Welcome to Money Savage, a savage approach to personal finance. This is George Grumbacher, and the time is right. Welcome to today's guest, the strong and powerful Mark Kantrowitz. Mark, are you ready to do this?
Yes.
Excellent. Let's do this. Mark is the publisher and VP of research at savingforcollege.com. He is a nationally recognized expert on student financial aid, scholarships, and student loans. His mission is to deliver practical information, advice, and tools to students and their families so they can make informed decisions. Excited to have you on. Mark, tell us a little bit about your personal life, some more about your work, and why you do what you do.
Well, in my personal life, I have a hobby of breeding and showing hairless cats.
Okay.
And I also fold origami models.
Nice.
And I do what I do because it gives you a great feeling to help people and accomplish their educational goals. And I've, over the course of my career, I've helped literally hundreds of millions of students figure out how to pay for college.
That is incredible, sir. I'd be remiss if I did not ask how you got into your hobby with hairless cats.
Well, my wife has a degree in exotic animal training and management, so our pets are very well trained. And she likes unusual animals, and it kind of rubbed off on me. And she's more a dog person, I'm more a cat person. So when it was my turn, we decided that the Peterbald breed, it's a breed of hairless cat that originated in St. Petersburg, Russia, hence the name, would be a good breed for us to contribute to its development. And they are very affectionate, not just athletic creatures. They seek out sources of warmth, such as people's laps.
Nice. Okay. Which certainly makes sense, being that they do not have the natural defense against the cold that other animals do. So, and how long have you
They've been kind of like hot water bottles, because cats' body temperature is like 102, 103 degrees.
Okay.
So and they love to snuggle under the covers. I've been doing it for well over a decade.
Got it.
I've been involved with cats for much longer, but as a breeder, and I've been involved for over a decade.
Wonderful. Nice. All right. So you've been working in the student financial aid realm for a good little while. I'm just curious what your experience has been, how you've really seen it change from when you started to where it is today.
Well, I've been working in the field for over three decades, and I'd say probably the biggest change is the increase in college costs. I mean, every year, the cost of a college education increases. Every year, the average debt at graduation for a bachelor's degree increases by about $1,000 to $2,000. So it's becoming less and less affordable.
And why is that?
Well, it's because government support of post-secondary education does not keep pace with increases in college costs. Especially on a per-student inflation-adjusted basis. It's been going down for decades, and that shifts the burden of paying for college from the federal and state government to the families. Family income has been flat since the year 2000, and there was a little bit of an uptick last year, but it's essentially been flat, which means families don't have more resources to pay for college. That gives them two main choices. Either they send their children to lower-cost colleges, which is a phenomenon that we're seeing evidence of. They're shifting from private colleges to public colleges, and from four-year colleges to two-year colleges, and from two-year colleges to no post-secondary education. Or they borrow more, because student loans are the only form of financial assistance that has any degree of elasticity. And so that's a primary driver of increases in student debt. In addition, the cuts in government support, especially at the state level, are a primary driver of public college tuition inflation. If state appropriations go down, as they tend to do during every recession, the colleges have only a few choices to make up the lost revenue. One is to increase tuition, which drives increase in debt. Another is to shift enrollment from in-state students to out-of-state and international students who pay higher out-of-state tuition. They can increase reliance on part-time faculty like adjunct faculty who get paid less and don't receive benefits. And they can increase class sizes to make it, quote-unquote, more productive. But that affects the quality of the education because each student then gets a proportionally smaller share of FaceTime with the faculty members.
Got it. Do you see, I think it's an interesting thing you have, since the Great Recession, so many people going and getting, at least this is my perception. My perception is that so many more people went and got an MBA. A lot of people enrolled in law school, maybe that they wouldn't have, to get these advanced degrees, to get better jobs. And then they're graduating and they're not necessarily finding these better jobs. So maybe I'm wrong there, but do you see in the future that having a really detrimental impact on people's desire to pursue these traditional routes of, you know, advanced degrees to get better jobs?
Well, during an economic downturn, we see something called the countercyclical effect, where people are having trouble getting jobs, go back to college, get an additional credential to make themselves more marketable in the job market. This recession was no different. There was a bump up in college enrollment above the baseline level. Some of the traditional methods of getting a good paying job, such as law school, have been a lot less effective. There's some people say that we might have a glut of attorneys. So it's no longer a sure thing to get a good paying job. You know, you might be doing the work of a paralegal, even though you have a law degree, unless you happen to graduate at the top of your class or from a top 10 law school where you're more likely to make partner. There are, however, some fields where an increase in income or just the likelihood of getting a job are a more sure thing. STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, as well as healthcare. There's a very strong demand for nurses. But we still see in some weakness, in some areas there's not. According to the Center for Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University, of the 2.9 million jobs that were created during the economic recovery, 2.8 million went to people who have college degrees. So having a college degree is still one of the most reliable methods of getting a good-paying job. In some cases, you may be taking away a job from someone who has less education because employers are continue to express preference for people who have a college degree. But on the whole, unemployment rates for people who have college degrees are lower than for people who do not have college degrees. Salaries are higher. So it is a more reliable method of ensuring a livelihood.
Makes sense. So we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater just yet.
No.
People are still going to continue to go to college.
You need to be sensitive to keeping your debt at graduation in sync with your income after graduation. Ideally, your student loan debt at graduation should be less than your annual starting salary, and ideally a lot less. If your total debt's less than your annual income, you can afford to repay your student loans in 10 years or less. But if your debt is out of sync with your income, you're going to struggle to make those loan payments, and you'll need an alternate repayment plan like extended repayment or income-driven repayment, which means you're going to be in debt for 20, 25, or even 30 years. So clearly, you need to avoid borrowing too much for a degree that doesn't pay as much.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent rule of thumb right there. And obviously, we maybe don't have the benefit of a crystal ball and knowing how much you're going to make. But to a degree, you do, because you can look at average incomes of first-year people in the job that you want. So I think that's excellent advice right there, a nice rule of thumb. So talking about if my son is 18 years old and he's about to go to a state university and he's looking at different private loans to pay for college, are there different kinds? Are there merits to one or advantages to one over another?
Well, first of all, it's good that he's going to an in-state public college because that's often your cheapest option. The likelihood of needing debt is lowest for students who attend an in-state public college. As far as loans, I'd recommend borrowing federal first because the federal student loans are cheaper, they're more available, and they have better repayment terms than private student loans. Private student loans and federal Parent PLUS loans should only be considered after you've exhausted the loan limits for the federal Stafford loan, a student loan. But you should also, if you find yourself needing to borrow private or parent, you should express a lot of caution because that may be a sign that you're overborrowing. And while the federal student loans are a good way for the student to have skin in their game, you're extremely unlikely to borrow excessively if you're a dependent student borrowing the federal Stafford loan. The maximum you can borrow from the federal Stafford loan as a dependent student over 4 years is $27,000. With 5 years, it would be $31,000. And there's some evidence that students are bumping up against those loan limits, but the average starting salary with a college degree is a little over $50,000. So you're not going to be overborrowing on just the federal Stafford loans alone. Now, among the private student loans, there are two main types. There are private student loans that are made by commercial lenders, and there are private student loans made by state loan private student loans that are made by state lenders. So they're some of the state loans are very similar in cost to the commercial loans, but some are a little bit cheaper and maybe have benefits that are similar to those of the federal loans. Death and disability discharges. In Rhode Island, there's an income-based repayment plan. So you're more likely to see those kinds of benefits with the state loans as opposed to the purely commercial private student loans.
Nice. It just popped into my head, so I figured I would ask, is it true that student loan debt can't be discharged in bankruptcy?
It's extremely difficult to discharge federal and private student loans in bankruptcy. There's an exception to discharge at 11 U.S.C. 523A8 that says that unless repaying the student loans represents an undue hardship on the borrower and the borrower's dependents, they can't be discharged. Undue hardship was never defined by Congress, so it was left to the courts. And there's two main approaches. One is the Bruner test. The other is the totality of circumstances test, which is kind of similar but gives the courts a little bit more flexibility. The Bruner test is a three-pronged test that says you must currently be unable to maintain a minimal standard of living and repay the student loans. The second prong is that the circumstances that prevent you from repaying the student loans must exist for most of the life of the loans. And the third prong is that you must have made a good faith effort to try to repay the loans, like using options that have been provided by the lender for alternate repayment plans or deferments and forbearances, so that it's not that you just graduated and you want to try to get rid of your loans. You actually have to have tried to repay the loans. But the statistics are less than 0.04% of students who seek a bankruptcy discharge succeed in getting a full or partial discharge of their federal and private student loans. Now, it may be easier to get private loans discharged if those private loans don't offer, for example, a disability discharge like the federal loans do. So one could argue that your disability makes it difficult to repay the debt. But the challenge is these loans, it's not as simple as saying, I declare bankruptcy. It's rather, it's an adversarial proceeding within the lawsuit, where the lender can challenge your petition for discharge, and they can you have to provide evidence that you just don't have the money to repay the debt, as opposed to merely asserting it.
Got it. 0.04%. Not easy to do. All right. And let's just use the same example of an 18-year-old. I guess the better question is, your advice to parents who have a child that will be going to college in the next 5 years for actually seeking out scholarships instead of pursuing loans?
Well, with scholarships, every dollar you win is about a dollar less you're going to have to borrow. I mean, some scholarships do get displaced depending on the college. I mean, you tell the college, I just won a $1,000 scholarship, and the college says, thank you, we're reducing your grant by $1,000. Luckily, 80% of colleges don't do that. But so every dollar you win is about a dollar less you're going to have to borrow. Every dollar you save is about a dollar less you're going to have to borrow. The best ways to find scholarships are to use one of the free online scholarship matching services. The most popular ones are the College Board has their Big Future website, and FastWeb has a free scholarship matching service. I suggest searching at least two free scholarship matching services. On savingforcollege.com, we have an article in which we list 15 of the most popular free scholarship matching services. Never pay money to find out information about a scholarship or to apply for a scholarship. If you have to pay money to get money, it's probably a scam. But the websites like FastWeb and the College Board intentionally exclude any scholarship that has any sign of an application fee. And these websites provide you with a targeted match. You complete a personal background profile where you list your grades, your academic interests, your hobbies, your sports, and they match you against large databases of scholarships that have selection criteria that match your background. And then it's up to you to apply to these scholarships and hopefully win. I have a couple of key suggestions. One is, on these matching sites, you're going to find optional questions and required questions. Students who answer all of the questions, required and optional, tend to match about twice as many scholarships as students who answer just the required questions. And this is because the optional questions are there to trigger the inclusion of specific awards. I'll give you an example of a rare question, but there are questions about students who have been affected by cancer, either themselves as a survivor or a parent or a sibling has had cancer. Now, there are about 24 scholarships for students affected by cancer, but they can't show you those awards unless you answer a question about whether you've been affected by cancer. Now, there might not be cancer. It might be specific fraternal organizations to which your parents belong, or unions, or it may be an academic majors. But there's a long laundry list of these questions that help target these scholarships to you. The other thing is, apply to every single scholarship for which you're eligible. All too often, students don't like to apply to scholarships that have small dollar amounts or involve writing an essay. Now, if it's a $500 scholarship, it's probably going to be easier to win because there will be fewer students applying because, well, it's only $500. But it takes you typically half an hour to an hour to complete a scholarship application. And if you have a 1 in 10 chance of winning that scholarship, say, then, and you complete 10 of them, well, your odds of winning one $500 scholarship is pretty good, assuming that you have a solid background. So that's $500 for 10 hours of work, or $50 an hour. I don't know of any teenager who is able to earn $50 an hour doing something legal.
Right.
Now, with regard to the essays, the students don't like writing essays. Maybe they have difficulty expressing themselves. Maybe they encounter writer's block. But there's a very simple technique that makes it much, much easier. And that's, instead of writing down the answer to the essay question, record yourself out loud answering the question. And the reason why this works and yields a much more passionate and powerful essay is that people write or type at about 30 to 60 words a minute on average, but they speak at about 200 words a minute. So the act of writing interferes with the flow of thought, whereas if you're recording yourself, it's at the speed at which you can speak. And at 200 words a minute, if you have to write a 300-word essay, speaking for a few minutes yields more than enough material. Now, it'll be stream of consciousness. You'll have to transcribe it and make an outline from it to give it some structure. But you'll get more than enough raw material that you can refine into a really good essay.
That is great advice right there. Well, Mark, Savage Nation is ready for your difference-making tip, even though you've given us so many already. What do you have for them?
Well, I would recommend that you start saving for college as soon as possible, even if it's just a small amount per month. Set it up, make it automatic, and it takes advantage of your greatest asset, which is time. It's the magic of compound interest, and means that if you start saving from when the child is born, about a third of your college savings goal will come from the earnings. Whereas if you wait until the child enters high school, less than 10% of the savings will come from your earnings, and you'd have to save six times as much per month to reach the same college savings goal. So, I mean, take advantage of your greatest asset, which is time.
Well, that is great stuff. That definitely gets a come on. Come on! And Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can Savage Nation learn more about you?
Well, our website is savingforcollege.com. Where we provide not just information about saving for college and 529 plans and Coverdell education savings accounts, but also about paying for college, such as scholarships, the FAFSA, student loans, and other good advice. I also have a website called studentaidpolicy.com, where people can find my over 100 student aid policy analysis papers, which are the source of a lot of advice and insights about planning and paying for college.
Excellent. Well, Savage Nation, if you enjoyed this as much as I did, show Mark your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Go to savingforcollege.com and studentaidpolicy.com, both of which I will list in the notes of the show. Thank you again, Mark.
You're welcome.
And until next time, keep fighting the good fight, because we are all in this together.
What's up, Savage Nation? Please support the show by subscribing, leave us a review, and definitely feel free to share us with somebody you think would like it.
Come on!